This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Vice President Kamala Harris has just landed at CVG Airport. She was greeted by Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear. The vice president is in Cincinnati today. She'll be joining Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, the Democrat, to visit the University of Cincinnati's 1819 Innovation Hub. There will be a roundtable discussion about infrastructure and public transit systems. WVXU reporter Tana Weingartner is traveling with the press pool, who is accompanying Vice President Kamala Harris on this trip. She'll have reports at WVXU.org as well as here on 91.7 throughout the afternoon, so stay tuned for that. A quick traffic note, as you can imagine, as the vice president is traveling from the airport in Kentucky to the University of Cincinnati, it appears that 471, first of all, just about completely shut down right now. The traffic cams are off, which is pretty typical for when we get a visit from the president or the vice president. So not exactly sure where the motorcade is right now at this noon hour. But the best advice we can offer right now is just to avoid 275 and 471 right now, as the vice president and her team and that van of reporters, including our very own Tana Weingartner, makes its way up north of the city to Clifton for a visit to the University of Cincinnati with Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden has reached his 100-day mark this week. He laid out his plans and hopes for the nation during a joint meeting of Congress. And joining us now to talk about it, our Washington Post senior editor, Mark Fisher. Mark, welcome back to our show.
Great to be with you.
And for the first time with us, Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne. E.J., thank you for being with us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So the vice president happens to be visiting our little town today to talk about public transit and infrastructure. Mark, when the vice president is rolling around the country now to push the president's agenda following this address, what do we expect in terms of messaging strategy? She's, you know, they choose these destinations usually pretty strategically.
Well, as the president, he likes to think of the whole COVID challenge, the jobs challenge, all the major challenges before the country. He sums it up in three words. Well, really the same word three times: jobs, jobs, jobs. And so he's taking the message to battleground states to try to send the message that Democrats, despite what Republicans and right-wing media say, the Democrats do have a real appeal to the middle class and are concerned about putting the economy back together again. That's a message that is perhaps lost sometimes in the battles among Democrats. And so Kamala Harris's job is to kind of reiterate that and to reach out to voters in a way that, you know, the speech to Congress the other day, because Joe Biden is such a creature of the Senate, it was really pitched rhetorically to the members of Congress. This is the chance to go out and make the same pitch, but in different terms to voters themselves.
EJ, after the president's speech, even during it, we heard some, you know, instant analysis that have made some pretty bold comparisons to previous presidents. We're talking about Franklin Delano Roosevelt, President Johnson, so Lyndon Johnson. You did write an editorial talking about Biden going big, going bold, going populist. You said it's not exactly the New Deal or the Great Society, which are also references to FDR and LBJ, but you said it was equally ambitious. Tell us about that.
Well, I think that that Joe Biden is trying to alter the political conversation in a fundamental way, really finally move the nation off the Ronald Reagan track and onto a track that you might even call social democratic, certainly New Deal-ish, but focused on a series of very practical problems that people confront, whether it's in childcare or an ability to go to community college or pre-K. In other words, there are basic human needs where government can be helpful. But I think the other piece of what he's doing, and I think Kamala Harris's visit there today is very important in reflecting this, is that he's trying to say that investments by government can boost the private economy too, that investing in alternative energy can create jobs. And I think he's there partly to see if maybe your Republican Senator Rob Portman might be brought around on infrastructure, and maybe even putting a little pressure on Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell over the other side in northern Kentucky. My understanding is that one of the infrastructure projects that the president is interested in is that bridge that I understand you guys have been seeking down there. That would be an Ohio and Kentucky project. I'd be surprised if it isn't mentioned by Kamala Harris.
And of course, that's a reference to the Brent Spence Bridge, the bridge that connects Covington and Cincinnati via Interstate 71 and 75. It has been deemed to be functionally obsolete. Obviously, we had it shut down late last year after a fiery crash involving two semis. 6 weeks without access to that major interstate bridge. Right now, it is undergoing a long maintenance project through November. Multiple lanes restricted in both directions. Mark, when you have a specific example of infrastructure in a community like we have here in the Cincinnati area with the Brent Spence Bridge, is there a way to make that seem like a tangible goal to voters here and the public here after so many years of being told things about it and obviously not seeing it come to fruition yet?
Yeah, this is a perfect example of how Joe Biden wants to use his practical background in the Congress, in the Senate, to transform the country, to do the big, bold things that EJ was talking about, and to do it kind of piecemeal through infrastructure projects, through jobs programs, and through child care credits, all those kinds of very practical, hands-on kinds of things that government can do. He wants Americans to think again of government as something that can help them. We, you know, obviously, since the years of Ronald Reagan, Americans have been told again and again that's a laugh line, the idea of government helping people. But now we have very fresh, practical examples over the past year of people depending on government in big, very intimate kinds of ways for the checks that got people through, for the food handouts, for the COVID vaccine, all of these things that are government projects. And so Joe Biden's trying to kind of turn this giant steamship of the American society back toward an orientation that says government's not such a terrible thing. And he realizes that he's not going to get those Republican politicians in Congress simply by schmoozing them at the White House. And so he's turning his attention to the voters. And he's, again, talking over and over about how bipartisan that he talked about in the campaign, that he has kind of redefined that. It doesn't just mean getting Republican votes in Congress. It means, he says now, getting Republican voters, because only through those voters can he hope to maybe swing some of those Republican votes in Congress that he needs to get any of these big things done.
We're talking with Mark Fisher and E.J. Dion of The Washington Post here on Cincinnati Edition. E.J., as Mark just referenced, Americans may have experienced government support in a new way or even for the first time because of the COVID-19 pandemic and those necessary steps that Congress members felt the country needed and the presidents have both felt that we needed in order to survive during the economic downturn brought on by the restrictions related to the COVID-19 virus. Do you think that this could be lasting? Do you think there's possibility for more appreciation for what the government can do for you?
I hope I'm attributing this right. I think it was Chris Hayes on MSNBC who said the other night that, you know, Reagan's old joke, I'm here from the federal government and I'm here to help you. And that's supposed to be a laugh line, as Mark suggested. And Chris Hayes, I think, said, if somebody knocked on my door and said, I'm from the federal government and I have this vaccine to give you so you don't get COVID-19, somebody would not laugh. They'd say, come on in and give me the vaccine. And I think what we've seen over and over in this period is people saying, you know, the government can be helpful. There was Bill Cohen, the former Republican senator from Maine, who later worked for Bill Clinton, said, government is the enemy until you need a friend. And I think in this period, Americans had a re-engagement with the idea that in emergencies, in a lot of circumstances, government aid is absolutely necessary. Biden is trying to take that one step further in saying that for a long time in our history, we use government to invest in research and development. The internet itself came out of some Defense Department research. We've had extraordinary breakthroughs in medicine because of government help. And he's trying to say we can make these investments to expand our capacity to create alternative energy, to produce semiconductors in the United States across a whole broad area. And it's not always an easy sell. Americans still reserve a certain skepticism of government. But I think the experience of the pandemic opens people up to two ideas. One is government can do good things. And two, we really have become very unequal as a country when we look at the inequalities in the country that the pandemic really dramatized. If you missed them before, you can't miss them now.
President Biden is seeing pretty good approval ratings right now, particularly when asked about specific issues. Voters are giving high numbers, for example, to the American Jobs Plan, which the president touted during his speech this week. EJ, are Republicans having a hard time finding a message against the president right now?
Yeah, they clearly are. And I think they had to resort to saying that Democrats want to outlaw beef, no hamburgers on July the 4th. And I have a suspicion we're going to have pictures of Joe Biden eating a hamburger on Independence Day, just to guess. But I think they're having trouble because Joe Biden is a uniquely unthreatening, avuncular figure. He is, just to be straight up about it, an older white guy who expresses some rather old-fashioned values about religion, about family. So he doesn't really threaten the constituencies that the Republicans might want to try to motivate against him. And again, as Mark also alluded to, the broad things he's talking about, more people would like more options on childcare if they are parents with young kids who have to work. People would like more options for going to community college and be able to sort of get either a chance at a college education or job training that they need to get good jobs. So he's a president of the basics. And so Republicans are having a really hard time. I think, just real quickly, the most striking things about his approval rating is not the approval rating, which is by no means off the chart. It's that his disapproval rating is relatively low. And in a highly polarized time, just not being hated is a pretty big achievement. And that's where Joe Biden is.
Mark, Mitch McConnell obviously has represented Kentucky in the United States Senate for a long time. He's very skilled in the operations of the Senate and has been working alongside Joe Biden in some capacity for decades. They know each other well. In your observation, your long observation of the way Washington works, have you seen any difference in the way Senator McConnell, now as minority leader, is trying to use his old playbook or adjust that playbook at all in trying to formulate any type of strong opposition to the president's agenda?
Well, I don't see a whole lot of change in the way Mitch McConnell operates. It's a pretty steady line, and he is the master of obstruction. He's going to go right back to that old playbook. But there is a difference here because Joe Biden knows all the tricks. And Biden, you saw in the address to Congress, he made a couple of asides directly to Mitch McConnell. He's trying to play those relationships. Whether it will work or not is hard to say. I mean, obviously, Biden's key to his success has always been those relationships, both with voters and with his colleagues in the Congress. But I think what's happening here is we have a president who, like Gerald Ford and Warren Harding behind him, before him, came to a country that was in deep crisis, in Harding's case, a world war and a worldwide epidemic, just as we've gone through. In Gerald Ford's case, after a deep trauma of the disgrace of Richard Nixon. And so Joe Biden has that same dynamic where he's trying to recreate some sense of normalcy. And part of that normalcy is reconnecting with Congress, seeing if Congress can become a functioning institution once again. That part is going to be very hard for him. He's got the atmospherics are working extremely well for Biden in these early days, just as they did for Gerald Ford before he pardoned Nixon and messed up his popularity. So inevitably, those kinds of things will happen. There will be policy confrontations, and McConnell will use those in a way that that will be as obstructionist as ever. Biden's real test will come in whether he can persuade the public to understand that what Republicans are doing is pure obstructionism and nothing more.
It seems, Mark, that part of restoring calm and normalcy, as some writers have put it, and you explored this possibility this week in a column at the Washington Post, it does seem that part of this is just having a president who isn't disrupting our day-to-day lives with outrageous social media posts, who isn't saying something ridiculous or mean on national television. Can you talk a little bit about what that pivot has meant, what that adjustment has meant at all, if anything, in the national discourse?
I think it's made an enormous difference already. And, you know, when you talk to people outside our country about our long history of poor voter participation, they tisk-tisk and they say, oh, isn't that terrible? In fact, I would argue that our history of low voter participation is sometimes a healthy sign, in that Americans have, through much of our history, had the freedom, the luxury, the privilege of not having to care that much about day-to-day politics. Obviously, during the Trump era, everybody had to care. Whether you liked him or hated him, he made you pay attention because you never knew what he was going to do, and you never knew how dangerous things were going to be. Joe Biden's entire presidency to date is about calming things down and fixing that and taking us back to a point where a lot of Americans don't have to care. So he had a almost record low viewership for his address to Congress the other night. I would argue that's a good thing. That means that Americans are tuning out, going back to their lives, taking care of their families, looking for work, all the things they need to do, and they don't have to be at the edge of their seat worrying about what the president's going to do or say. That's a big success, although it does make it hard for him to build on that and bring people along for these big policy initiatives that he's considering.
That's Mark Fisher. We're also joined by E.J. Dionne, both from The Washington Post. E.J., we're at the 100-day mark of the Biden presidency. And of course, that doesn't technically mean anything. It's sort of this arbitrary cultural milestone we attribute to presidents, and that they also look to accomplish goals in that time frame. I'm thinking back to the Democratic primary and the general election campaign itself, and we saw Joe Biden manage to stumble at times, fall behind others, figure out, you know, how to be steady. Now that he's in office and we've had 100 days of watching this, is there a definition of Bidenism and what a Biden presidency will likely mean?
Let me just go quickly to two things Mark said first. First, I love that he cited Warren Harding, a good Ohio person on an Ohio radio station. Doubt the Biden administration is going to court that particular comparison. But what he said about Joe Biden feeling, making people feel easier, it reminds me of Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado, who ran for president. He didn't go very far. But he had one of my favorite campaign promises. He said, I promise you that if you elect me president, you will be able to go 2 full weeks without thinking about me at all. And I think after the Trump era, a lot of Americans kind of welcome that. I think Bidenism is about the use of the federal government to further rather traditional ends. Not traditional in, right-wing ends. Obviously, he's spoken. He wants to end racism in police departments. He is in favor of LGBTQ rights. I mean traditional in people worry about their families and how to take care of their kids. People worry about whether their next job will pay them what the old job they might have lost in manufacturing paid them. And so Bidenism is about saying, government can do some very concrete things to make life better, and we're going to pay for it in a progressive way, which is why the Republicans attack Biden and saying he wants to make us more like Europe. In some ways, what he is trying to do is import some of the things that Europeans have done with childcare, with healthcare, with job training and apprenticeships that have worked rather well in other societies. In many ways, we are behind our richer, our wealthy peer countries in using government in simple, basic ways to make life a little bit better, and that's Bidenism.
And Mark, before we let you all run, I mean, who do you think in the political class is most surprised by the way President Biden has operated in the White House? Because there was certainly criticism of him from the farther left elements of the Democratic Party. There was varying degrees of criticism on different issues, of course, from conservatives and Republicans. And now we see how he's acting as president. Who do you think's most surprised?
Well, I think two groups. First of all, as you mentioned, people on his left, Democrats who worried that Joe Biden was going to be a centrist or even conservative figure as president. I think they're now seeing that this is someone who, as a Republican mentioned to me the other day, Joe Biden says the things that the left-wing Democrats believe, and when it comes out of his mouth, it sounds reasonable. So that's probably been a surprise to people on both sides of him politically. And then I think also people who have known and worked with him for decades are probably a little bit surprised to see the quiet confidence of this Joe Biden, the willingness to play a little bit of a more background role. He was known for many years in the Senate as a motor mouth, as a guy who just couldn't shut up. And so this is really, whether it's a factor of aging or of the wisdom or of his sense of what the office requires of him right now, what we're seeing from him is that very soft-spoken guy who we saw speaking to Congress the other night. That is not the Joe Biden people knew from the 80s and 90s.
What a pleasure it's been to have Mark Fisher and EJ Dion, both of the Washington Post, with us today. Mark, EJ, thank you for the time you gave us. I do hope we can do this again sometime.
It was a great job. I hope so, too.
Awesome. Thanks. Thanks, guys. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Cincinnati voters will choose the top two candidates in this year's mayoral election when ballots are counted next week in the primary. Additionally, they will consider a few charter amendments, one of which would mandate that the city spend $50 million annually in support of affordable housing opportunities. So what is the city's affordable housing shortage? WVXU reporter Becca Costello is with us now to help us better understand. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Michael.
I understand that we have a very specific number related to the number of units that we're apparently missing in the affordable housing range.
Yeah, well, so first of all, this has been a number that's been under dispute for a little while. The number that we hear used a lot, including on Cincinnati Edition and in my own reporting, is this estimate of 28,000 units needed in the city of Cincinnati. So that data is a little bit old. It's based on census data from 2010 to 2014. And so obviously a lot has happened since then. So there's this effort to kind of see what's the latest data on that. Talking to some national experts, I was able to find some more recent data looking at the 2013 to 2017 area. And that shows a gap of about 19,230 units that are affordable and available to extremely low-income renters. Now, one important distinction there is that the 28,000 number comes from a LISC report, and that looked at renters and owner-occupied. So the numbers aren't exactly comparable, but it does just give us a more recent estimate.
So that's the report that had previously also suggested that there's 40,000 units countywide in Hamilton County that the county is lacking in affordable housing, right?
Right. That 2017 LISC report that's based on the 2010 to 2014 data. A lot of dates here, and I apologize for that.
No, that's okay. Well, tell us a little bit about how these new numbers were crunched.
So these are numbers that come from HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And so they do annually a report about housing affordability. And you can look at that regionally through sort of the metro area or by county or by the city. And so we worked with a research analyst from the National Low Income Housing Coalition to kind of crunch those numbers and analyze the data for us. And so we mentioned a 19,230 unit gap for extremely low-income renters. And for Hamilton County at large, it's a 29,700-unit gap estimate.
And you have a interactive, I don't know what to call this. Is it a chart on WVXU.org that people can see across the region, the Cincinnati metro area's affordable housing situation, right?
Yeah, so it's an interactive table. It includes the housing surplus or deficit for all of the 15 counties in the Cincinnati metro area. And that's the census defines that metro area for us. So we can see that Hamilton County does have the largest gap in terms of the number of units needed. But you can sort through that and see, you know, what some of the other counties are looking at. And that's important, too, because part of this discussion is, you know, housing is a regional thing for the average renter or, you know, homeowner. Living in Norwood versus the city of Cincinnati isn't necessarily a huge difference. So that can be interesting to see kind of what the gaps are in the nearby areas in the metro.
We're talking with Becca Costello, WVXU reporter, who focuses primarily on Cincinnati City Hall. So we've been talking about affordable housing for a while, certainly on this program, regionally, and about the lack of units available to people of certain incomes. And it does appear that people are in agreement that something needs to be done, but whether this Issue 3 charter amendment ballot measure that voters will see when they go to the polls, either already or next week, this may not be the way to go about it. That's debatable, according to whoever you might be talking to. It does look like, though, the city is taking some steps to address this issue. Mayor Cranley is pushing city council now to fund affordable housing with some of the stimulus money coming in, right?
That's right. And I will say there's definitely disagreement about whether or not Issue 3 is the right way to kind of solve this housing crisis. But I think it's pretty clear that the fact that Issue 3 is on the ballot has kind of lit a fire under City Hall for them to kind of look at other solutions. You know, they're saying we don't want Issue 3 to pass. So they're trying to come up with some other things they can say to advocates. See, we are doing something on housing. So we're getting about $291 million from the American Rescue Plan Act. This is the latest round of federal stimulus. And Mayor Cranley has kind of been advocating for his plan and the city manager's plan to spend that ARPA money. They have a very detailed plan to spend that. But we don't have any guidance from the U.S. Treasury yet. And city council is still kind of collecting public feedback, and council is more likely to be kind of more patient on that and wait for it. But Mayor Cranley's point is, you know, the sooner we approve the funding, the sooner we can spend some of it. So he's saying, you know, approve some of this money for the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, and we can kind of get some of that money out on the streets as soon as this summer.
Talk a bit about what role the private sector could play in this. I understand that that might be part of the plan.
That is definitely part of the city's plan. So basically, they've got this federal money they're applying for. It's $34 million from Housing and Urban Development that they could use to loan out to developers building affordable. It has also said they're committed to raising another $30 million from the private sector locally to also either loan out or distribute as grants to affordable housing developers. Now, we've talked about timeline. A lot of this could take a very long time. You know, we're looking at months before the HUD loan money is approved. And then negotiating those deals with developers can take a very long time. The same is true for the private sector. You know, as far as we know, as of Wednesday, they hadn't raised any money yet. They're just sort of launching this project. But that's definitely their goal, to raise that additional $30 million to use for this pool.
There is a disparity among current elected officials at City Hall about how much to put into the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. I understand that Mayor John Cranley has suggested, while members of council David Mann and Jan-Michelle Lemon-Kearney have proposed $50 million. So that's a bit of a gap between where they are. When should we expect any movement on these fronts?
It's a great question, and it does depend on a lot of factors. For one thing, I know Councilmember David Mann, who is chair of the Budget and Finance Committee, has told me, you know, it really doesn't make any sense to decide how much to put into the Affordable Housing Trust Fund from ARPA money until after we have the results of the Issue 3. Because one thing to note is Issue 3, as you said, requires the city to put $50 million a year into that trust fund, but it explicitly says that the city can't count any federal or state funding sources towards that $50 million. So if the city's obligated to put $50 million from the general fund or however else they choose to pay for it, then, you know, Councilmember Mann is saying it wouldn't really make sense to put another $50 million in from the ARPA funding. So that's one factor. The other is the plan that the city manager and Mayor Cranley put together sort of has this guesstimate on how much the deficit for this year and the next couple of fiscal years will be. But there's a lot of question marks as far as how much that deficit is. And each week we get a little bit more information about, you know, how we can estimate those deficits. And so another thing on Monday is we'll be getting a little bit clearer picture from some University of Cincinnati economists who will give us a better idea of how to predict those deficits. So there really just is a lot of question marks, and it's going to be a couple weeks at least before we know anything more clearly.
We've got less than a minute left, Becca. There was another housing-related issue discussed and voted on at City Hall this week related to the temporary eviction protections that emerged during the pandemic. Can you give us a quick update?
So this came about when the Hamilton County courts decided to no longer honor the federal eviction moratorium. And so locally, the attempt was to give some eviction protections. This is basically called pay to stay. So under Ohio law, a landlord can initiate eviction proceedings if rent is just a single day late, and they're not obligated to accept rent payments late, so they could continue that eviction. So these protections put in place temporarily basically say the landlord has to accept the late payments if the tenant can pay all back rent and all fees, they would be allowed to stay in their home. Now, there was an attempt to make that a permanent change. That did fail at council. So right now, it's only this eviction protection in effect as long as there is a statewide state of emergency due to the pandemic.
Becca Costello is a WVXU reporter. Becca, thanks for spending some time with us today.
Thanks, Michael.
And up next, local restaurant operators saying welcoming diners back is great, but they're still waiting for more workers to show up. We'll look at that shortage and some of the causes. A quick reminder that Vice President Kamala Harris is in town, so traffic disruptions are expected through various parts of the day, including now on the highways around the Cincinnati area. You can follow that at WVXU.org and here on air. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. More restrictions on restaurants are being lifted as the COVID-19 pandemic eases. And that means more diners are returning to tables inside and out. But one group isn't returning quickly enough for some local business owners, the workers. Cincinnati Business Courier reporter Andy Brownfield explored what restaurant operators in this region are facing. I spoke with him earlier via Zoom about that. Andy, welcome back to Cincinnati Edition.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Your story starts with a place a lot of us know, the Bronte Bistro inside Joseph Beth. And they basically had to tell their customers that they were closing for a couple of days out of a week. Now, for the past year plus, we've grown quite accustomed to restaurants having to close because of either restrictions or maybe a COVID case emerged among the staff. This was different, though. Tell us about it.
Yeah, you know, they just weren't able to find the workers to stay open all 7 days a week. So they're closing Mondays and Tuesdays to give their staff just a break, time off, so that they can enjoy time with their families, not be working already crazy hours in restaurants. And they're not alone. This is really impacting everybody from fast food to fine dining.
Well, we've heard arguments on political shows on cable news, for example, and there's been some analysis in newspapers that perhaps these extended unemployment benefits and that sort of thing is enticing people not to return to their lower wage gigs, which often server jobs do fall into that category. Your story explored that this wasn't necessarily the case, certainly not the only factor. Talk about some of the factors that are facing the restaurants themselves and the workers also, and why they're not returning to these gigs.
Well, as I alluded to earlier, these are really grueling jobs. There's no such thing as a 9-to-5 restaurant. Though, well, I'm sure there are, but a lot of these serving and cooking jobs require people to work late into the night, and they aren't always the best paying, though that is changing. A lot of restaurateurs and chefs are really having to up their game in terms of pay and benefits. You'll see people offering 401k with employer matches, health benefits, dental benefits, just to convince people to take a shot and work in their restaurants. But on top of that, these are frontline jobs with people, and we're still in the middle of the pandemic. The vaccine is rolling out and restrictions are lifting, but a lot of these serving, hosting jobs require people to interact directly with the public. And you know, not everybody is always as friendly or accommodating when it comes to wearing their masks out in public.
You talked also with Christian Gill, a chef here in town. He's the owner of Boomtown Biscuits and Whiskey, which is located in the Pendleton neighborhood. He's apparently planning to open up a couple of new restaurants this year, another Boomtown in Union in Boone County, and also something called the Mighty Slider Bar, which will be in Blue Ash. So you note that restaurants are upping their game in terms of incentives that might lure workers back to their operations. But Chef Christian Gill said that he's not necessarily facing competition just from other restaurants, for example. He cited Amazon in particular. So there are just other jobs out there.
That's true. Amazon, it is 9-to-5, and it is a higher paying option compared to some restaurant work out there. And the fact of the matter is, the restaurant industry was among the hardest hit in the initial onset of the pandemic when the governors of both Ohio and Kentucky forced restaurants to close their dining rooms. So a lot of these workers, they have gone on to find employment just in other industries, other places where they could start working immediately without having to collect unemployment and wait for their former employers to welcome them back.
You spoke with Chef Jose Salazar. He's been a guest on our program before. He's the owner of Salazar and Goose and Elder in Over the Rhine in Mitas downtown. He says that, my goodness, he'll put an ad up for a position that's available. He'll get 11 interviews scheduled and only one or two people actually show up. He says, quote, there's less respect or common courtesy to just show up for an interview anymore. It's a thing these days. So that seems to be something, based on his opinion, that might have even predated the pandemic, right?
Yeah, and it's not just him. There have been a lot of restaurateurs I've talked to who just aren't getting people to show up for job interviews. I don't know why that is, but it appears to be endemic for the restaurant industry that they'll put these feelers out there. They'll schedule a ton of interviews, and people just won't show up. It could be the competition is just that fierce that they have found employment elsewhere, or it could be just that I've had a lot of readers comment and email me saying that maybe these people are just searching for jobs, as is the requirement for receiving unemployment benefits, but then not following through.
I would imagine that these restaurants are trying to beef up their staffing, not just because restrictions are being lifted on them specifically and more customers are returning in general, but such restrictions are also being lifted in workplaces, and that's got to be critical for areas of the region like the Central Business District, where there are food operations that haven't had their usual clientele that would pour out of the office buildings. Did you hear any perspective from restaurant owners on that, that they do expect more customers to come in and maybe they're a little nervous about being able to accommodate them?
I think that's a big fear, especially in the Central Business District and some areas of Over the Rhine, like around Findlay Market, where a lot of the restaurants do rely on heavy lunch traffic just to survive. I mean, the margins on restaurants are razor thin to begin with. And when you add that, the fact that the captive business population that feeds these restaurants, or who these restaurants feed for lunch, a lot of people are hoping for a staffing up of the downtown business population again, and they themselves need to staff up to meet that demand. And it's a very real fear that they won't be able to, open their doors to coincide with the return of workers downtown because they can't find the personnel themselves.
We're talking with Andy Brownfield, a reporter at the Cincinnati Business Courier. You have other stories this week about restaurants. It's not all bad news. There's obviously some problems with bringing workers in, according to the owners of some of these restaurants, but we've got a bunch opening, particularly in Newport. I'm going to get to Newport in just a moment, but you profiled a local chef, Josh Campbell. He's the owner of Django Western Taco, that flagship location closed in Northside back in October. And you characterize what's going on with him now as a rebound. This is probably a restaurant a lot of people in the city got to know at some point. What's he doing?
Well, he is a hustler. He is a guy who just will not let the blows get him down. When the coronavirus pandemic first forced him to close his dining rooms in March of last year, he partnered with the Hungry Brothers food truck to kind of license their truck to bring his food out to the masses. And that has worked so well that with the closure of two of his brick and mortar locations, he's gone on to purchase first a food trailer that can serve in the same capacity as a food truck. And then when a colleague of his in the Sunnyside brunch food truck decided to sell, he jumped on that too. So he's ended his partnership with Hungry Brothers, but now he's got two food trucks of his own. And he said that if he could do sales in 3 hours that would normally take him an entire day to do in a restaurant, just because with the restrictions, he can take his food to where people are instead of relying on people coming to him. And on top of that, he signed on as the food provider for the Queen City Riverboats in Dayton, Kentucky, and the upcoming OTR Stillhouse off Central Parkway.
I thought it was interesting to learn from Josh Campbell that the margins are apparently better on food trucks. He says, quote, the margins are a lot better on food trucks. The opportunities are a lot better. We're taking it to a captive audience. It's just me and maybe Kona Ice, he says. So I was surprised to learn that perhaps the numbers seem to work better on food trucks than in a restaurant.
Yeah, it's a trade-off, I have to imagine, because with a restaurant, you've got all the overhead, you've got the rent, utilities, staff, and a food truck. It's something that he can do by himself or with one or two other people. Whereas in a restaurant, you've got your host, your hostess, your servers, full kitchen staff. And again, you're relying on people to come to you rather than the ability to go out. But then food trucks are also just so weather dependent. On a day like the last 2 days we've had, with it being rainy and kind of dreary out, it may not be the best time to go out and hope people will walk to your open air food truck.
I want to talk about another restaurant in the downtown area. It's at the Banks. It's called Gala Park Steak. And a lot of people may have been reading recent coverage of this. It does face closure by the city, which has accused it of multiple violations related to liquor and selling alcoholic beverages to underage customers. But in spite of that, the owners of it are opening another location. Tell us what's going on here.
So this has actually been something that's been in the works for a long time. I first talked to the manager, Mike Mercer, there in 2019, and he said that it was always the intention not just to open a restaurant, but to create a brand. And they had signed a lease up in Columbus in 2019, and that finally came to fruition this month. They opened up the second Gala Park location in, I believe, an expansion of the Easton Town Center up in Columbus. And it's essentially the same concept, but with a heavier restaurant focus than the club scene.
Meanwhile, as it relates to the Banks location, it appears, according to your reporting, that there was a court date scheduled for July. It's been canceled and a settlement is being pursued. Is that right?
Yeah, the city had been seeking to have it declared a nuisance property, which would shutter it for a year. But they are working towards a settlement that would avoid, well, in a perfect world, avoid that. They are open currently. And the restaurant group that owns that location, they have declared Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection as they seek to reorganize.
We're talking with Andy Brownfield. He's a reporter at the Cincinnati Business Courier. Let's go to Newport, Andy. The Newport on the Levee has, you know, weathered the pandemic seemingly well. There's been a lot of new businesses opening up, events that they're hosting there. They've been doing a lot of stuff outside in particular, but they made a pretty big announcement this week related to who was coming there. Tell us about this latest slate of names that will soon hang on signs at the Levee.
Yeah, speaking of Columbus and Cincinnati synergy, Four Entertainment Group, or 4EG, they're one of our largest bar operators in Cincinnati. Most of the partners are locals here, though they do have some properties in Chicago. They opened up a bar called The Beeline in Columbus, and they are copying that concept and bringing it to Newport on the Levee. This will be inside of the actual Levee Gallery building, but it'll have garage doors that will open up to views of the Ohio River and the Riverwalk and downtown Cincinnati. It's going to be a craft cocktail bar with craft beer and wine as well, but a menu of Red Bull cocktails. And 4EG, they're not stopping there. They are also opening The Buzz, which is going to be as managing partner Bob Deck told me, a connection to the Beeline. And because they kind of have their own open container district down there, Newport-on-the-Levee, he said it'll be they view the entire area as kind of their courtyard. Now, The Buzz is actually going into the Bridgeview Box Park, which is a bunch of shipping containers that have been converted to food and beverage spaces. And joining The Buzz at the Bridgeview Box Park will be the Crepe Guys, which is a French
crepe. This one sounds interesting because they're apparently wildly popular on the other side of the ocean.
Yeah, you know, it's a France-based franchise that is very popular in Europe, and I believe this will be the first location in northern Kentucky. But they have over 40 varieties of both sweet and savory crepes, and it's taking the place of the banh mi food Box, which is actually relocating to the gallery building itself in Newport.
Yeah, a lot of cool stuff there. Also, another brewery appears to be setting its sights on Newport.
Yeah, West 6, which has locations in Lexington, Frankfort, and Louisville, is opening its first Northern Kentucky location in the Bridgeview Box Park. They are joining more food and beverage operators, the Black Market Saloon. That's an outgrowth of Farmhouse Lemonade, which debuted in the Box Park last year and is also moving into a larger space. But it's taking some of the fresh squeezed lemonades from Farmhouse and adding some spirits to give them a turn them into cocktails. They're also going to be offering chips and salsa to give your stomach something to absorb some of that.
And again, we're talking with Andy Brownfield, a reporter at the Cincinnati Business Courier. And Andy, before we let you go, let's keep talking about brewers for just a moment. Apparently, some craft brewers are looking at Cincinnati's West Side.
Yeah, so this is Verge Brewing. It's a team of two fathers and daughters. They actually met through the Blatarian Society. It's a craft brewing club here in Cincinnati, a home brewing club. And they decided to make a go for it themselves. Now, they've won dozens of medals with their beers in local and national competitions. And they're hoping to open up on the West Side. And currently, there are really only two craft breweries that serve the West Side out of nearly 70 in the region. They've turned to Wonder Fund, which is a crowdfunding platform that was created by, coincidentally, another craft brewery owner, Marvin Brenica of Esoteric Brewing. And it allows people to, it allows companies to crowdfund from the general public, which a lot of people are familiar with through things like GoFundMe or Kickstarter. But unlike Kickstarter, where you get maybe some swag or goods for supporting a business, here you actually earn or own a piece of equity in the business that you're investing in. Now, they haven't signed a lease yet, but they are looking at locations in Delhi and Green Township and Price Hill.
That's Andy Brownfield, a reporter from the Cincinnati Business Courier. Andy, I'm glad you could spend some time with us today and hope you have a great weekend.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And thanks to all of you for listening as well. We hope you also have a great weekend. We finally made it. I want to remind you that the cicadas will be emerging at any moment, and you can find WVXU's Brood 10 podcast, a 10-part series, already online at WVXU.org. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. This theme music composed by Rob Fetters. Find archives of this program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. Have a great weekend. We'll talk again on Monday.